One of the best ways to earn more money is to start a side hustle. Part of growing your side hustle is working with the best tools to help you succeed. Shopify is here to help. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to did we just hit $1 million order stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify's easy-to-use system allows you to set up a sales page, take payments, and start putting your new ideas and products out into the world with ease. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to help support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/beginners, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/beginners now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/beginners. When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card worth more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Love this podcast because it crushes your dreams of getting rich quick.
They actually got me into reading stats for anything.
You're tuned in to the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Led by Andrew Sather and Dave Ahern.
Step-by-step premium investing guidance for beginners.
Your path to financial freedom starts now.
Starts now.
All right, folks, welcome to Investing for Beginners podcast. Today, we welcome back our special friend, Vitaly Katsanelson, CEO of the Denver-based investment firm IMA, award-winning writer known for his common sense, great storytelling, and wisdom. He's written for Financial Times, Barron's, and his articles are published on my favorite website, Contrarian Edge. Vitaly is joining us today to discuss his third book, Soul in the Game. Vitaly is easily one of my favorite writers, and I've been enjoying his articles for years. They bring wisdom, great insights, and fantastic stories to investing and life. So, Vitaly, thank you again for joining us today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to come talk to us. And we're really excited to talk to you about your book and all the things that you got going on. So I guess my first question is, do you consider yourself an investor who writes or a writer who invests?
Wow. Well, first of all, Dave and Andrew, thank you so much. So in the past, I was somewhat embarrassed that I wrote so much, and I would say I'm an investor who writes. And now I am just look at myself as a person who also invests, but who thinks through writing. Because investing is just one of my identities. You know, it's my main occupation. I spend a lot of time doing this. But I'm so much more than just an investor, right? And writing is now an inseparable part of my personality, of my identity. Because without writing, my IQ, you know, would be 20 points lower. And I need, my IQ needs all the help it can get. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I guess what prompted you to write this great new book, Soul in the Game?
Over the years, I would write articles. I would send them out to my readers. And a lot of times, some of my articles were about investing. Most of them were. But there were, over time, more and more, you know, I started to write about non-investment topics. And people would reach out to me and say, Vitaly, you should take your non-investment articles and put them into a book. And I was somewhat resistant to that because, you know, I still was certainly kind of conflicted about my identity. So I thought I was an investor who writes. But then I wrote this article about Tchaikovsky and about his struggles he had writing, you know, this beautiful sextet for strings. And when I wrote this article, I realized that the struggle Tchaikovsky had composing that beautiful music is very similar to the struggles anybody who writes goes through as well. So after I was done with this article, it hit me over the head that somebody who reads it will actually, who wants to learn how to write or who is struggling as a writer would really benefit. But more importantly, I realized I have written so many articles over the years just like that on somebody that they could help others. So my goal was just really take all the articles I wrote about life, put them into a book, and that was it. But then I kind of did that. And then when I was almost done with the book, and when I say almost, I think literally working on the last chapter, I stumbled on Stoic philosophy and ended up, you know, telling my editor at Harriman House that I need to take a break and I just really want to study Stoic philosophy. And I ended up writing almost a third of the book about Stoic philosophy, completely for this book. And in all fairness, I ended up going back and writing a lot more new articles, new essays or chapters for this book, rewriting old ones. So it's a lot more than just a collection of my articles, I hope. You know, you guys can tell me what you think about that. So,
yeah, I definitely think it's more than just a compilation of your articles. And I think, you know, the thing that I enjoy about your writing in general, but just about the book too, is you do such a great job of weaving stories and wisdom kind of together. You've had an interesting life prior to coming to the United States, mm-hmm. as well as some of your adventures here in the United States. And I think that the kind of the juxtaposition of the, I guess, the two separate lives, mm-hmm. and then coming to the United States and kind of how you look at those things through investing, to me, has always been very interesting. And because I've been reading your writing for so long, I feel like I kind of know you and I know your family. And even though I've never met your kids, I feel like I know your kids really well. And I know the Stoic philosophy became very important to you because you could see it in Twitter. It kind of changed your Twitter threads or your posts changed from more investment related to pretty much focused on Stoic philosophy. And so it's okay. He's definitely going down that rabbit hole. So I wonder where that's going to go. And so that was why it was kind of cool when I got the book and was able to start reading, and I was, okay, now I'm getting it now. I can understand where that's kind of going.
I think it's actually, I would argue, Dave, my Twitter thread is kind of a reflection of what I'm reading and doing at the time. So if you see what I'm reading and doing, just follow me on Twitter and say, yeah, you get a very accurate picture.
Yeah, for sure.
I was wondering, Vitaly, thanks for coming on, if you could maybe expound for people who aren't familiar with you and your great emails, what is it about writing that makes your thinking so clear when it comes around investing? And do you think it's something that average investors who are trying to manage their portfolio should try to implement in their process?
Yeah, okay. No, that's a great question. I think a very important question. So let me tell you about how I write first. I wake up about, it depends on the time of the year, but let's say about 5 o'clock in the morning. I make a cup of coffee, and then I basically write for 2 hours straight. I try not to get distracted by other things. I put my headphones on, put classical music on, and write. And I do this every single day with very rare exception. So now, if you think about it, what is writing? Writing is focused thinking, because you're thinking about a subject and your mind is just focused on that. So if you think about it, I'm involved in focused thinking 720 hours a year, at least. That's a lot of focused thinking. Okay. So for me, I think it's very important because I have a scatterbrain, and for me to have thought that's where all the parts are connected together, that's what writing does. It basically connects all the elements of the thought together. And now I have a thought that I can share with the world. Also, it's a process of discovery. The way I look at writing is basically, it's a creative process that connects our conscious and subconscious mind. We kind of know what we think, like, as at this point in time, on almost any subject. That's the knowledge we have in a conscious mind. that's accessible to us. But the subconscious mind is this huge reservoir of knowledge that the only way I can access that by sitting down and doing the focused thinking. Now, this whole conscious subconscious mind is kind of, it's a, some people may say it's kind of a voodoo concept or something. But if think about this, when you read a book, you read what, 80,000 words. You don't remember, like, you remember the concept generally, right? But you don't remember every single word you read, right? But I would argue a lot of that information, some of it was retained in the conscious mind. A lot of it is deposited into a subconscious mind. And I don't know if you guys had this experience, but I had an experience when I would write and suddenly I'm using the word that is kind of new to me, even though I just wrote this word. And it's just basically, Dave, you're laughing, but it probably happened to you, right? Mm-hmm. And because what happened was at some point in time, in some book, I read that word and it was deposited in my subconscious. And then when I was writing, it just, you know, kind of floated to the surface. So I would argue everybody should write. Again, I'm a biased person because it has been very helpful to me. As an investor, I think, well, first of all, I think when you buy a stock or we sell a stock, you should write a journal of why you're buying stock and why you're selling the stock. Because what it does, it truly fleshes out your thinking. And then you will be able to see when you have to express, put your thinking on the paper, you'll be able to see all the deficiency, all the holes in your thinking. And then you actually decide not to buy the stock. Okay. Because that's almost like exposing your thinking to another evaluation, I guess. I think everybody should write. I wish I wrote a journal. And if I did not write 2 hours a day, I would write a journal. And I highly advise other people to do this. And at some point in time, I need to create this new habit. I may write starting a journal in the evening before I go to sleep. But I think journals would, I write so much that I just, I think I wrote a journal for either 2 weeks or a month. But I found that it was, I did it in the morning and it was always competing with other things I wanted to write. So that's why I'm not writing the journal. But I would highly advise people to start, you know, at least with writing, you know, a daily journal.
First, you probably know the bad news already. Mint has shut down. But here's the good news. There's a better alternative. Monarch Money. That's right. Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. As a finance nerd, you would assume that I have my money game all together. Well, shocker, I didn't. Until Monarch Money. Monarch Money allowed me to easily see what is going on with my finances, help me get a better handle on my spending, budgets, and more. It's my go-to app every day, more so than my bank, because I can quickly see where I am with my budgets and spending, allowing me to invest more and spend time on things I want to do. It's my GPS for money. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now you get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. Monarch has a tool that allows you to easily import your data from Mint and keep all your tags and categories. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product. They release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. In fact, Monarch Money is one of the first to bring you direct Apple Card, Apple Cash, and savings syncing with the latest iOS 17.4 update. Now you can sync your wallet directly for seamless budgeting. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. That's monarchmoney.com/beginners for your extended 30-day free trial.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
I think I really like that advice, and especially the part you're saying where you're trying to figure out whether you want to buy a stock or not. I've had newsletters, Dave, you know this, where I pretty much got to the end and then decided I wasn't going to buy the stock. And like you said, Vitalik, just kind of want to double click on that idea because it's so key. I think you're really filling in the holes that you don't even realize are in your thought process about a company until you have to. I mean, I've seen it with myself where I'm fleshing out an idea and then I'm like, well, what is the data that supports that idea? And then you have to go in the writing process to find that data. You might have never thought about that until later on because you were forced yourself to go through this writing process of fleshing out your thoughts and putting that subconscious to the conscious.
Absolutely.
So how often do you, I guess in your writing, look back at things that you have written about, and how often are you changing your philosophy or your ideas or some of the ways you think about the world? One of the things I really liked that I read in one of your emails, which I try to at least, if I can't read all of them, at least skim them, because there's always a valuable nugget in there, it seems, is you talked about how we make these biases based on our circle around us of, I see my five friends doing this thing, and so I think the whole world works this way. So, you know, that's kind of like this, I feel like an advanced idea that maybe, I don't know if you were maybe aware of it all your life or if you never knew it existed and then you discovered it and then wrote about it. But like, how often are you coming across those discoveries or maybe like changing your mind about certain ideas? And is it going back to your old writing or is it just kind of trying to learn as much as you can and it just kind of naturally happens?
So I think you were talking about the myopic circles idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have changed my mind. And a lot of times, my experiences, as you grow, you learn, hopefully, right? And my goal, I'm happy to change my mind what I'm, in the future on what I'm thinking today if I arrive to that in a kind of very thoughtful way, right? So I think it's important to go back and look at your thinking and looking for a couple things. Number one, you're looking for the assumptions you made. Like now I'm talking about, let's say, I'm buying stocks. Like, well, look at all the assumptions I made in the past and ask yourself, are they still true? Also, look for the logic, if I had a flawed logic or if that thinking was just flawed based on the information I had at that time and if the world has changed and now I need to update my thinking on the subject. Like when I wrote the myopic circles, let's talk about that. That myopic circles, I think it's a very interesting framework. So let me expand this a little bit. So I don't smoke. I used to smoke when I was 21 years old. I quit when I was 21. And at that time, so if I look at my friends today, none of them smoke. So, and because we are attracted to people who are like us, who share similar values. You know, I'm not judgmental about people who smoke. It's just, their values, usually smoking comes with other values that usually conflict, with my values. And therefore, it's very easy to think, to have this myopia that people don't smoke, right? Well, in reality, 14% of Americans smoke. So statistically, we know it's not true. But here's the interesting part. If you find somebody who smokes and those people, most likely their friends also smoke because they're attracted to people who smoke. So like I have a circle that I have this life where my experiences limit my understanding of the world. And I assume that the world is as I see this. But the world is actually a lot more than what I see, right? And there are a lot of people who have different experiences than I do, etc. So the reason it's important to understand, when you analyze companies, like how it's very easy for us to think that, I'll give you one example. We're analyzing a company that does money transfers from the United States to Mexico. So my first thought was when I started to analyze the company, well, this company is going to be out of business. Why? Because who needs these services if you can just send money by PayPal or Venmo or whatever? Mm-hmm. When I started to do more research about the company, I actually had to go and so this company focuses on the Mexico corridor. So people who send money from the US to Mexico, most of these people are migrant workers that come to the United States. So I actually ended up going to Mexican neighborhoods in Denver and observing these people. And I realized they live in a different world. You know, they barely use credit cards. A lot of them don't have checking accounts in the United States. Most of their relatives in Mexico don't have checking accounts. They live in a cash economy. And so therefore, they don't even know how to spell PayPal. You know, my point is they don't use PayPal. And they probably won't be using PayPal for a long time. So me going and exposing myself to the new world, kind of exposed myopia that I have. And so now when I'm analyzing a company, I'm thinking, is my experience to that company's service limited by my kind of limited experience. You know, I'm constantly thinking about that.
That makes a lot of sense. So I guess when you're thinking about those things, you know, how do you research some of these ideas? Like, I'm thinking in particular about the Stoic philosophy. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when you sit down to write for 2 hours, you know, we all know you open a computer, you look at the blank screen and like, oh, how do I put stuff on there? Where do you gather the research to fill the head to start putting stuff into writing?
So before I wrote about Stoic philosophy, I probably read a dozen books at least. I listened to, I don't know, 50, like, I can't even tell you how many podcasts I listened to. I a lot of learning. So if I can write about something, first I need to learn this, right? And then writing helps me to learn it better. But I wrote this book, like, I'll give an example. I wrote a book about a small series of articles about Tesla. And by the way, your listeners and viewers can, you know, get the free version of this book at teslaanalysis.com. It was a 9,000 word essay or something, a 15,000 word essay about Tesla, which is a very deep dive into Tesla. Well, I spent probably a month learning about it. Everything I could, I read Musk's biography. I read as much as I could. I watched a lot of YouTube videos. I listened to a lot of podcasts. Ended up did a lot of reading. So that's prerequisite to writing.
Yeah, that I love. The idea of having to research all that information to be able to put it down, I think is very, very helpful. I think that sometimes people feel like that it just comes to you, but, you know, they don't realize that there's a lot of work that goes into, you know, those 2 hours that you're spending.
And, you know, what's important to understand is knowledge is cumulative. In a sense, when I was writing about Tesla, I had to use my knowledge from owning Apple stock, all the research I did on Apple, all the research I did on Nokia, because I was using Apple and Nokia as analogies. So, this is what I love about investing, that the longer I do it, the better I get, because this knowledge doesn't go away. It just accumulates.
So I'm thinking again about maybe somebody who's turning in for the first time. They don't know anything about business models. Maybe the idea of Tesla or the idea of Apple excites them. So can you give like a basic overview of that analogy and why that like makes sense for investors?
Yeah. Okay. When I was analyzing Tesla, a lot of people were comparing Tesla cars to kind of traditional, what's called internal combustion engine cars, ICE cars. And they were basically saying, well, it's going to be very easy for Ford, General Motors and others to make electric cars. And I use the analogy of dumb phone, smartphone analogy. Okay. So when Nokia came out, I own Nokia. So it's kind of interesting. I'll give you a small story. I owned Nokia in 2004 and Motorola came out with a flip phone, and Nokia kind of struggled for a few months, and they didn't have a flip phone. And Nokia struggled for a few months. The stock declined. And then 6 months later, they came out with a flip phone and I doubled my money. It was great. So that's not the lesson. The lesson was when in 2007, Apple came out with iPhone, I was like, well, I know how this, last time this happened, I made a lot of money. So I bet on Nokia. And the problem is this was not a change in the way the phone looked. This was a form factor, right? This was a complete change. It's the phone went from one domain of a dumb phones where to a smartphone, which is, which the first one was there to make phone calls and had maybe a little bit computing power, a little bit. Well, where smartphones were really just a computer that does 200 other things plus also makes phone calls. So, and I made a mistake, because I did not recognize the difference. I did not recognize that we shifted into new domain from dumb phones to smartphones domain, which is basically all the knowledge that you have in a dumb phone business. Actually, most of it is going to hurt you. Because think about Nokia at the time, generalizing now. If you think about dumb phone, it's 90% hardware, 10% software or whatever. And a smartphone, the software is as important as hardware. I'm not sure it's 50-50, 60-40. It doesn't matter. But the software is incredibly important. So that means Nokia was designed for a very different product. So where iPhone could just focus from a blank slate perspective on focusing on the smartphone, Nokia basically had to let go of a bunch of engineers, which it won't need, to design hardware, a brand new talent, which it didn't have, operating system. And to make things even worse, Nokia had its operating system, Symbian, which was basically created for dumb phones. And what it tried to do, because it has a lot of Symbian engineers, tried to adapt that operating system for smartphones. And it failed miserably because originally it was not designed for that. So this is one framework. Now, if you think about electric cars versus C cars, so the Tesla is a lot more than just a car that has an electric motor, right? It's a, first of all, think about General Motors. I don't know how many engineers it has that are trying to squeeze extra efficiency from ICE engine, from the engine, from the ICE, you know, internal combustion ICE engine. Well, it won't need any of those engineers. It doesn't need any of those engineers for the electric motor, right? And also, the, you know, electric car, Tesla car is a lot, you know, the software is so much more important in that car than it is in the, you know, old cars. So my argument was that transition is going to be a lot more difficult for the traditional manufacturers. And Tesla actually, the fact that it's never made ICE cars, that's a huge advantage.
What's the best way to get started in the market? Download Andrew's ebook for free at stockmarketpdf.com.
I like that a lot because, you know, to a certain extent, you're right. It's not, you know, I'm going to rag on value investors being one myself. A lot of value investors look and wanted to value it as a GM or a Toyota or a Ford when it's not any of those cars. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the future, but you do have to kind of think of it in a different way if you're going to have the conviction to hold on to a stock like that for the long term.
And let me make a couple extra points about Apple, which is kind of, you know, that's important if you own Apple stock. Let me tell you, today I'm going to be talking about all the mistakes I made. So we own Apple stock. We made a lot of money. So we actually ended up selling Nokia. I think we took a 40% loss. On the first time I doubled money, the second time basically, I think we lost 40%. And then we bought Apple in 2012 and we made a lot of money on this. But then I made an assumption in our models that the iPhone prices would decline. You know, why? Because every single time you had a consumer electronic, the prices per unit declined. You know, well, Apple did unthinkable and actually raised prices and the demand hasn't changed. And so my mistake in my analysis was that I looked at it in the world where you have where consumer electronics became a commodity for the most part. Well, Apple, because it's really just, you know, splits market share with Android. And once you buy Apple phone, you are very unlikely to switch to Android. That Apple actually has a lot of latent, which it increased. And you ask me about if I go back and look at my assumption, you know, what I wrote. Well, that was a mistake. That was a clear mistake in my analysis. And so we sold Apple 100% ago. Like, you know, it's doubled since we sold it. And the decision was wrong. That part of the decision was wrong because earnings power went up for the right reasons.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. As the guy who wrote a great book called Active Value Investing, are you looking at companies like Apple and Tesla as the market seems to keep falling? Are you even allowed to say fund?
I can look at anything I want. No, of course. No, I'm looking at a lot of companies that have fallen and I'm naturally attracted to them, especially, you know, high quality businesses. At the right price, I'd be happy to own, you know, Apple again and probably Tesla as well. It's at some price. Yeah.
All right. So I'd like to switch gears a little bit here. And we talked about like getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning every day to write. That's a habit.
Yeah.
And you talk a lot about your struggles with sugar, your struggles with meditation, and being able to do it and not do it. So how do you develop better habits?
Okay. So, no, it's great. I love this question because I think I figured something out a couple of days ago. I want to share with you guys.
Okay, good, because I'm dying to know.
So the best way to develop habits is to start small. If you want to start writing, just start writing 5 minutes a day. Start with a sentence, something very easy, and just keep coming back. By doing this, if you do this long enough, if you do it for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, it's going to turn into a habit. Okay, and just try very, very hard to keep this habit. In fact, don't try. Say, I'm a person who writes. And when you say this, that becomes your identity. Now, to create habits, it's also important to link them to something else or stuck habits. So I'll give an example. And this is I meditated the whole year without a single skipping a day by linking meditation to my walks in the park. So I walk in the park every single day in any weather, almost any weather. Okay. So I meditated for a year without skipping a day. But you know what happened? And then I fell off the wagon. You know how it happened? I just figured it out finally. I think this winter, when I went to walk in the park, it was incredibly cold for a few days. And I could not sit and meditate. It was just too cold. So guess what happened? I skipped meditating for a few days. And then now I'm trying to get back into it. And I'm going to, and since I tell myself I'm the person who meditates, I'll get back into meditation again. But I realized that, like, when I linked my habits to walking in the park, which is fine, worked all the time except two or three times. But those three times was enough for me to, you know, to kind of, fall off the wagon. But that's how you create your habits.
So the small steps and kind of stacking, I think, yeah. Is that the kind of the idea that James Clear was talking about in his Atomic Habits?
Exactly. And I think I highly recommend that book. It's a phenomenal book. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I got it from him. I actually worked and improved it a little bit. So I'll give you this analogy, this thing I do. I found, maybe I forget when, maybe I think it was 6 months ago, maybe a year ago, I lost track of time, that I drink too much coffee. I literally found myself drinking 6 cups of coffee a day. And I like coffee. Maybe the first cup I like because of how it makes me feel, but the rest, I just kind of like the flavor, which is, I just drink black coffee. But what I found that maybe second or third or sixth cup are really, I consume them mindlessly. I just wander and make coffee. And so what I started doing, I said, okay, for every cup of coffee, I need to do 30 push-ups. Ooh. And so now my consumption of coffee dropped to 2 or 3 cups of coffee a day. And I do push-ups. And I got healthy. And, you know, you don't have to do, you can do crunches if you want, whatever you want. You know, you don't have to do push-ups. Right. Everybody wins, right? Like, you know, because I drink less coffee and I'm healthier. Another thing, for anything you do, create what I call a minimum measurable unit. And I rode a bicycle. And every time I rode it, my MMU was just get out and ride. Then was get out and ride for 20 minutes. Then was ride and have at a certain speed or have so many revolutions per second. And every single time I would increase it. And that became my meaningful unit. When I walked in the park, it was the same thing. But then I hurt my back and I still force myself to walk, but just for as long as I can bear pain. But just have something you can fall back to. Okay, I'm going to do at least that.
Did you have like a checklist or something? Or are you one of those people that likes to have like a notepad or something that, you know, so you can cross off the list or you can track your progress kind of thing? Does that help you?
I know it helps some people. It doesn't, if I was keeping track of a lot of things, and I would advise somebody not to do this, just keep it simple to just a few things. But like, you know, Jerry Seinfeld has this streak thing where every day he had to write a joke and, you know, that's fine if that works for you. You know, I don't need to do this because, you know, I keep it in my head. But again, just a few things a day. But if it helps you, just, you know, maybe you can cross it on a calendar. Even, you know, I did this day.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We've got a very different kind of sponsor for this episode, the Jordan Harbinger Show, which is a podcast you really should be listening to. And I know that every day someone tells you that you just have to listen to some podcast and you nod and say, sure, and then you never listen to it. Don't let that happen here. Jordan's show, which Apple named one of the best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusion about what's happening even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different fascinating guest, and when I say there's something for everyone here, I really mean that. In one episode, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you, which sounds useful and disturbing at the same time. Another episode tells the story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. For example, I also recommend our listeners check out Jordan's conversations with Dan Ariely about why people believe irrational things and Mark Andreessen about exploring the power, peril, and potential of AI, both spectacular episodes. Jordan's always focused on pulling useful, practical insights out of his brilliant guests. And we're not talking about pop psychology or wishy-washy self-help stuff here. The episodes are loaded with bits of wisdom that you can use to legitimately change your mind and improve your life right away. If that's not worth checking out, I'm not sure what is. We really enjoy the show, and we think you will as well. There's just so much here. Check out jordanharbinger.com/start for some episode recommendations, or search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Right. As somebody that's a failed meditationist, what would you tell me to improve that? I've tried and it just never took for me. I've tried it 2 or 3 times. I read actually about your struggles with it early on and it just didn't work for me. So I guess what would you tell me?
So I think I failed at meditation first before I succeeded for at least a year. The reason I failed because I had wrong images of meditations, okay? You know, like the images you see of this beautiful skinny woman sitting on the cliff of the mountain looking at this either sunrise or sunset, and she had a ponytail. And I realized, oh my gosh, for me to meditate, I need to find something like this. Well, in reality, you really don't. Some people can meditate in a very loud environment, you know, next to jackhammer, kind of, you know, sound of jackhammer. So you can really meditate anywhere. And, that's number one. Number two, the reason people get frustrated with meditation because they try to sit and breathe and not to think. And when they try not to think, they fail at that miserably. Okay. And they basically say, oh, I cannot not think. Therefore, I'm not going to meditate. What they don't realize that that's a feature, not a bug. By you trying not to think and failing, you're creating a new habit of observing your thoughts. And like when I meditate, my MMU is 1 minute. I just try to get this 1 minute of perfect meditation out of 10. Okay. And I failed even that it's 1 minute, you know, half the time. Okay. Right. But what you do when you close your eyes and you try to breathe and this thought comes to you and you want to notice that thought and that observation of this thought is incredibly important. The fact that you notice that thought, that's the skill you want to train. Here's why. Because that skill in itself will make you mindful. When you're driving in the car and you are, you know, somebody told you something, you're upset about something, and you observe this thought that you realize, oh, I'm upset about this for this reason. Just observation of the thought, you know, basically diffuses that thought and reduces your pain. That makes you mindful. That makes you observe your own thinking. This is why I think if you want to start with 3 minutes, 5 minutes, it doesn't matter. Start with something. And actually, but when I say this, I'm really speaking to myself as well because I need to get back on the wagon again. And I meditate maybe 2 or 3 times a week right now, but I want to do it every single day. So I'll start with, you know, Dave, if you do it, I'll do it. I'll do 3 minutes a day if you do 3 minutes a day. So, okay.
But that's, you got it. I'll do 3 minutes.
But anyway, but that's, you know, that's, that would be my advice.
I'm going to ask the dumb question here in the room. What's the biggest benefits that you've seen from meditation?
So I think some people would say it makes you calmer. I didn't observe that. Like it didn't make me more. Sometimes you get into the zone, like it happens rarely. You get into the zone where you'd see almost like you are high on, I can't even explain it. It's very difficult to explain. But that's not why you do this. It's what I just described. It's that you basically training yourself to observe your own thoughts. And by observing your own thoughts, reduce a lot of negative emotions that are constantly in the back of your mind. You don't even notice them anymore. I think that's probably one of the biggest benefits to me. Also, like when you sit down and you are trying to control your breathing, you know, it's, of course it's going to calm you down too, but that's not why I do it.
So does the meditation help you remove some of the self-talk, the negative self-talk?
It helps to neutralize. It helps to neutralize the negative self-talk. Yes. Because something little happens and this self-talk, negative self-talk, just kind of, it blows it up more and more and makes it larger, by us diffusing it, we reduce that, and therefore it has become a healthier life, I guess.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So can you explain to me what soul in the game means?
Soul in the game. Well, let's start with skin in the game, right? Skin in the game, when you share both upside and downside, when you're doing something, you know, for somebody else. Like, you know, when the karmic can, so when I manage money, all my liquid net worth is invested in the same stocks as my clients. So therefore, I have skin in the game. If I make a mistake on buying a company, then it's going to hurt me and it's going to hurt my clients. But it's, you know, the easiest example is when the cook eats his own cooking. Yeah, that's he has a skin in the game. Soul in the game is a kind of a next elevation of this, where the activity has so much meaning to you that you love this activity that it's basically becomes indistinguishable from your identity. And if you think about people who are incredibly good at what they're doing and who are dripping these emotions when they're talking about what they're doing, those people, or you know those people, like if you want to take your kids to a doctor, you want him to take it to the doctor who has soul in the game, who is not just doing it because he's trying to pay for his student bills. You know, the same thing with any activity in your life. When you go to a restaurant and you have this waitress who has this incredible personality who really wants to take care of you. You know, this woman has soul in the game. So it could be any activity. But that's basically what's kind of, on a high level, what soul in the game is.
I love that concept. And I love, that was probably honestly my favorite part of the book, was the soul in the game chapter, because I think that's something that has always attracted me to people and different things, is when you sense that soul in the game. I guess I had never put that connection together, but the soul in the game, I think that's something that I always found attractive, whether it's athletes, musicians, you know, investors, writers, you know, a waitress, anything. That was easily my favorite chapter in the book.
This became part of our culture at AMA. So when we do something, like peer people say, oh, you know, we got to have a soul in the game when we do this, or just don't do it. So yeah, so this is, yeah, that's very important to us.
I liked how in the beginning of the book, you wrote a little thing. You said to my children, and you had their names, and you said, because you never read my emails. So hopefully they read your book. Could you summarize?
Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe for any parents out there who maybe want to, maybe they have kids your children's age, and maybe they want to give a book like this to them. What would be some of the biggest parts of the book that could be helpful for those parents and those children?
That's a good question. I was talking to a reader a couple of days ago who read my book, and he was raving about it. And he said, I think every person graduating from high school should read this book. I was flattered by this. So, you know, I wrote it for my kids because in this book, I downloaded all the thoughts, all the things I wish I knew when I was their age. Okay. And when they're older, like I wish I knew them when I was, when I became a parent. So I think Stoic philosophy is something that could help anybody at any point in their life, actually. My 8-year-old is probably a little bit too young for that, but my 16-year-old daughter and 21-year-old son are primed for that. And we talk about Stoic philosophy all the time. And more importantly, I consider myself practicing Stoic. What does it mean? I try very hard to live by those ideas. Now, I fail all the time. And that because I'm trying to rewrite the behavior that's been formed for most of my life. So it's very difficult to rewrite. And so when I fail, I talk to my kids about it. And I say, here's what I did. Here's what I did wrong. This is how I should have done it. And I find that to be extremely important. Because my kids realize that it's okay to strive for that, and it's okay that you're not going to succeed every single time. But if you do this long enough, then you're going to rewrite your habits, and you're going to start, and the world is going to become easier to go through life. Let me just clarify what Stoic philosophy is. Stoic philosophy is basically, it's a 2,000-year-old philosophy out from Greece. When I say Stoic and I say philosophy, it sounds very scary and intimidating. But really, it's really not. It's a beautiful philosophy, very simple. And I look at it as an operating system for life. The reason I call it operating system for life, because when you're born, we're not really given, the way we behave is formed by our parents, by our friends, you know, by our life, right? I don't think we are really told, the Stoic philosophy provides this curriculum that helps you to deal with life and removes this kind of negative emotions. It lowers the volatility of negative emotions. How's that? And therefore, I think it could help anybody. And the beauty of this, it doesn't, you know, it's not a religious philosophy. So it doesn't conflict. If you're religious, it's going to help you. If you're not religious, it's going to help you. And it had a tremendous impact on me. And I'm still learning. I'm still practicing. I'm trying to improve. And hopefully next time we talk, I'll be better at that.
That's right. You, me, and Dave all three.
And Dave will be meditating at that point.
Yeah, maybe. At least 3 minutes a day. Exactly. At least 3 minutes a day. I'm going to start tomorrow morning, I promise you. I've been trying
actually, here's the thing, actually. Let me point something out. And I make this mistake all the time myself. So this is, when you say, I try, it's one thing. What you need to get to, we say, I'm the person who meditates. I'll give you an example. And this is actually from James Clear book. When somebody offers you cigarettes and you say, oh, I'm trying to quit smoking. That means, I can promise you, that means that you're going to, you know, fall off the wagon in about a week. Okay. Right. When somebody offers you a cigarette and you say, I don't smoke, right? Then you are the person that actually tells you that that's the behavior of my identity. Okay. I'm the person who doesn't smoke. So what you need to, like, when I say you, Dave, it's you and me. You and me.
Yeah.
Us need to get back to the point where we say, I'm the person who meditates. 3 minutes a day, it doesn't matter, 10 minutes a day, an hour a day.
Right.
But I'm the person who meditates, and then that will become part of your identity. By the way, anything you do like this, I'm the person who doesn't eat sugar. Therefore, when somebody offers me a cake, doesn't matter. I don't need, you know, it's a non-decision decision because I don't eat sugar.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you 100%. It kind of goes back to the whole Yoda quote in Star Wars, right? There is no try, there's do or That's do right. not. Yeah. So that famous Stoic philosopher Yoda.
That's right. No, listen. Why not?
So we've talked a lot about the different parts of the book and everything. Mm-hmm. And I would be remiss if we didn't discuss, you know, music. So I know music is obviously a very big part of your life. So I guess what can we learn from classical composers? I mean, how do you tie a lot of the book into music, and what can we learn? You know, even if it's somebody that doesn't listen necessarily to classical music, what can we learn from like Schubert and Chopin and some of the great others that you mentioned in the book?
Well, think about, they were all writing music. Okay. I'm composing music, writing, investing. Those are creative activities, right? Yeah, creativity. Yeah. Yeah. And therefore we can look at how their life stories and their struggles and realize that, and this is what we can learn from them. Let me tell you this funny story. There's this composer, Hector Berlioz, who grew up in France, and he fell in love with this Shakespearean actress. I think her name was Harriet Smith. He was in love with her, and he wrote her love letters, and she never replied to the letters. And he was so devastated, he rented an apartment across the street from her apartment. And he decided he's going to write a symphony just for her. It became called a Symphonie Fantastique, which is one of the most famous symphonies out there. The interesting part, Hector Berlioz started to study music late in his life. Well, late, all relative, when he was 12 or 13 years old. You know, that's relatively late. And therefore, he did not receive as much of classical education as many other composers. And therefore, when he was breaking the rules of music composition, he did not even know them. You know, there is a theory that he was completely high when he wrote the music. I'm not advocating for that part. But him not knowing the rules, or this is important, or he may be observing the rules and saying, those rules are not, it's not like they are, those are rules are just adopted conventions. It doesn't mean I have to follow them. By the way, that requires mindfulness. We were talking about meditation.
Yep.
You're doing this and you say, well, I'm supposed to do this, this, and this. And then you say, who said I'm supposed to? Anyway, so let me give you an example. Let me talk about Symphonie Fantastique because that's important. Before Hector Berlioz, there was no program symphonies. What does program symphony mean? So program music is the music that basically has a story inside of it. So the simplest example would be a musical, right? Or an opera. Mm-hmm. And opera has there was this story, a play, and then there was music on top of that. Okay. So, and that music kind of follows the story. Well, it was never done before with symphonies. Hector Berlioz, he had, you know, this love was raging inside of him, and he wrote this very dark story about, you know, dark story, and wrote a symphony around the story. Okay. And that symphony became an incredible success because people were not used to it and they loved it. So Harriet listened, you know, she was not at the premiere, but she listened to she heard the symphony. She started to take him seriously. They got married. And then I think her career kind of went downhill and, you know, the marriage fell apart. But now we have the symphony for the stick, because of her. So you can see how there's so much we can learn from Berlioz in whatever activity we are doing. There's a whole bunch of shortcuts. There is a lot of dogma that says this is how you do this. Okay. Like, let's go back to Tesla for a second. Elon Musk, when he was making electric car, the fact that, you know, he didn't actually have any experience of making traditional cars was a big benefit to him because he looked at it and says, well, when I make a four-wheel drive car, instead of having this complex transmission, I'll just put two motors on the front axle and the back axle. And that's how I'm going to make a four-wheel drive car. So that's an example of somebody looking at it and ignoring the dogma or not being influenced by how things have been done before. Another example, if you look at the Model 3, at the interior of the Tesla Model 3, it's a completely different design. It's not like it's a revolutionary, not evolutionary design. I mean, in the sense that there are no buttons. And if you are General Motors, engineer, interior designer working for General Motors, for the last 20 years of your life, you've been just changing the shape of buttons or their locations, okay? The idea of actually creating a screen like an iPad and putting all the controls there was just completely outside of your domain, right? We talked about how you go from dumb phones to smartphones, different domains, same thing. And so when you look at, you know, Tesla car Model 3, he basically completely changed how the car looks inside. And again, like Berlioz when he wrote Symphony for the Stick.
That's great. I love that idea of, I guess, breaking the rules, partly because they don't know the rules. I am a musician, but back in the day, I came across a gentleman who played in a big band that was from Australia, and he came from the outback in Australia. He didn't know the rules. And so he came up with a completely different way of playing the guitar that made him very unique. And it was because he didn't know the rules. And when you sat down and listened to him, it was just amazing. And yeah, I love that.
What instrument do you play?
Oh, guitar. Yeah, I went to college, got a degree in music, played in bands for years, did it until I wanted to have a family and, you know, I wanted to actually sleep in a bed. So it changed my life. So
it is very hard to earn a living as a musician. My niece graduated from Royal College of Music, which is kind of Juilliard of Europe, and she and viola. And now she's teaching a whole bunch of 8-year-olds, you know, and wipes the nose basically with your right, own education. So
it's a challenging life, but there's a lot of great things that come from it too. You certainly learn a lot of discipline and a lot of patience. And, you know, my grandmother used to have this saying that I've bored Andrew with a few times, that water dripping on a stone eventually makes an impression. And, you know, that was my guitar. That was my guitar.
So you could relate to a lot of the stuff I wrote about classical music and creativity. You could really relate to it, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. It was fantastic. All right. Well, Andrew, did you have anything else you'd like to discuss?
This was great.
Awesome. Vitaly, I do have to share a personal thing. You talk in the book about a trip you took, I believe it was with Mia Sara, to San Francisco, or maybe it was Hannah. I'm sorry. You were talking about just having moments with your daughter and how those are precious to you, and that's something that you guys will remember for the rest of your life. And that little bit has stuck with me, and I have an 8-year-old daughter, and there are times when I'm doing things with her that I have to remember to focus on what it is we're doing and try to connect with her, because those moments will stay with us for the rest of our lives. And it's not about the things we do. It's just about the time we share together. And I really enjoyed that story and really is moved. I wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you so much for this. Actually, let me just tell you a new story. Yesterday, we had a little scare and I took my daughter Hannah to the hospital. Ended up not being, fine. Everything was fine. But it was, the first hour was kind of somewhat scary. And then once she felt better, we just made it like a very fun and laughing experience out of the whole thing. When she was hooked up to the machine, to all the monitors and the machine starts to beep. I said, Hannah, you got to be careful. Your IQ is dropping. Like, you made all these jokes. And I'll tell you this, that experience with her again, obviously it's a good thing that it's, and it had a very good ending, okay. But we even tried to make fun of, that was a meaningful experience for us, just going to the hospital. But thank you for that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So, Vitaly, we want to thank you for coming on. You've got a ton of great resources. You have your new book, Soul in the Game. People can also check out your blog, contrarianedge.com, and you have a great email newsletter as well. Anywhere else people should check you out, or is that pretty much where they should go?
Well, no, that's a great question. So a couple things. First of all, I could not stop writing this book after it got published. So I already wrote 5 new chapters, actually, I'm finishing 2 more. So if you go to soulinagame.net, there are instructions where after you buy the book, you can send, you can basically get 5 new chapters I wrote since. So check out soulinagame.net and you'll be able to, subscribe to my articles there as well. Or people who listen to this podcast or watch it probably like to listen as much as they like to read. We have a podcast where basically my articles are read, to you by a professional artist. So it's a podcast. You can find it on investor.fm or just look for Intellectual Investor Podcast, or you look for my name and you find the podcast. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, and actually kind of get into a glimpse of my, what I'm working on right now or thinking about right now, it's my first name and last initial, Vitaly K.
Cool. Well, Vitaly, again, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate you sharing all your insights and your time with us. We know your time is valuable and we do really appreciate that. And it's all of his stuff is fantastic. I've been a big fan for a long time. I've really enjoyed his writing. You're welcome. And I've enjoyed his writing and his ideas, and it's all worth checking out. You'll be better for it. So without any further ado, I'll go ahead and sign us off. You guys go out there and invest with a margin of safety, emphasis on the safety. Have a great week. We'll talk to y'all next week.
We hope you enjoyed this content. 7 Steps to Understanding the Stock Market shows you precisely how to break down the numbers in an engaging and readable way with real-life examples. Get access today at stockmarketpdf.com. Until next time, have a prosperous day. The information contained is for general information and educational purposes only. It is not intended for a substitute for legal, commercial, and/or financial advice from a licensed professional. Review our full disclaimer at einvestingforbeginners.com.